Good afternoon, and welcome to this hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. I'm Chairman Michael T. Spencer, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Commissioner Dan Herzeps and Commissioner Lisa M. Gregory. Today is April 26, 2018, and the time is 2:03 p.m. We are convened at the Commission's hearing room today, which is located at 441 4th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. We are here pursuant to D.C. Law 610, the Rental Housing Act of 1985, as amended. This hearing, noticed at 2 p.m., is in regards to the housing accommodation located at 601 Buchanan Street, Northeast, B2, Washington, D.C. The tenant petition number is RHTP 30700. The case is styled Rosalind Bougeau, Housing Provider Appellant versus George Castillo Jr., Tenant Appellee. The Commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the Housing Provider Appellant.
Good afternoon. My name is Daniel Hornell, and I am representing Rosalind Bougeau in this appeal.
Thank you. And for the tenant appellee, could you say your name, basically, if you want?
My name is George Castillo, Jr., tenant.
Thank you, sir.
Petitioner.
Thank you. I would briefly like to explain the Commission's procedures. Our rules are similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present its case, beginning with the housing provider appellant. The housing provider appellant may preserve up to 5 minutes of its 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the tenant appellee's case. The tenant appellee must present all of its arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the Commission may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions that occupy a substantial portion of that party's time. We will issue our decision in writing and send it to both parties. In this proceeding, the Commission does not request nor will they accept post-hearing submissions from either parties. We are aware that Mr. Castillo has just filed a document at 152 that is entitled Statement Made in Defense of Final OAH Orders. I understand that a copy was given to the housing provider appellant. The Commission will take this under advisement. Are there any other preliminary matters in this case? Okay. Please turn off your cell phones and any other electronic equipment. And would you like to preserve 5 minutes?
Yes, I will, Your Honor.
Okay. No problem. Please proceed.
Thank you. And may it please the Commission. This is a case where the administrative law judge...
You can sit if you want to, sir.
Thank you. Where the administrative law judge ordered a massive refund of rent for housing conditions that existed from the beginning of tenancy. The Act, Rental Housing Act, does not give the Commission or the Rent Administration general jurisdiction over warranty of habitability violations, if any occurred. And in this case, simply as a matter of law, that is what happened. The Act only permits reductions in rent for reductions in services. And it is uncontested that the major reduction in service alleged in this case, which is a window that was too small for or below the code size for egress, existed from the beginning of tenancy. There was also a claim in this case that there was a crack in the foundation of the house. Again, it is uncontested that that existed from the beginning of the tenancy. The entire award was simply contrary to law.
When you say, let me interrupt you really quickly, because you raised an interesting argument. And so my understanding is that you're basically saying a literal reading of the statute requires that in order for a reduction to exist, it must occur after Tennessee has commenced.
Yes, that's correct. The purpose of the Rental Housing Act, and this is clear, is to protect tenants from rent increases and prevent them from being pushed out of housing that exists by landlords, as they often will do, reducing services to try to get tenants to flee over time. I primarily do tenants' work. This is one of the very few landlords I've ever represented. And if I could come to the Rental Housing Commission, the administrative law judge, and get attorney's fees for bringing warranty of habitability claims, I would do that for every case I have. That's not the law. And it's very, very clear. Again, the statute simply says reductions in services. It does not say that, the law assumes that the value of the unit is what was agreed to at the beginning of the tenancy. In this particular case, the rent was, I believe, $550 a month, which is quite inexpensive. It was never raised. And the price for that unit represents a fair value for a basement unit in that neighborhood.
So does it represent a fair value for a basement unit in a neighborhood that doesn't permit proper egress?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the window is 2 inches smaller than code. There's more than enough space to get out of that window. I've seen it myself. I visited it with the tenant. So the idea that it's unsafe, we simply disagree.
But does it violate code?
Yes, it does violate code. There's unquestionably that window is too small. My client did not know it was too small when she rented it out. Mr. Castillo did not know it was too small when he rented it either. This was only discovered, as the uncontroverted evidence demonstrates, in a housing inspection done by DCRA about 6 months before this case had its initial hearing in December of 2016.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you. This is a really interesting issue. Okay. So I have a lot of questions about it. So are you stating that $550 is the fair market value for a basement apartment, a basement room in that neighborhood where the window doesn't allow for proper egress?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think it's a very fair rent frankly, anywhere in D.C. that's a very fair rent. In this case, my client, once again, did not know that the rent window is too small. In fact, D.C. government passed a housing inspection before Mr. Castillo moved in. They told her everything was fine.
Did they know that room was being used as a bedroom?
Yes. Yes. The housing inspection for the basic business license, a housing inspector came through, looked at the room, looked at everything, and indicated that everything was passed. And I believe that's attached as an exhibit to one of our motions to reconsider, I think the first one.
I thought that was when they were under the impression that the whole structure was going to be rented as one structure as opposed to a rooming house. And so I thought, yes, it did pass inspection if you're renting an entire structure as opposed to renting individual living spaces within a greater structure, unless I'm mistaken.
I don't want to speak out of turn, and I just don't have it. Don't have it in front of me, so I'm really unwilling to guess for you. I will say that my client is an individual who owns one house that she inherited and is renting it out. She didn't have counsel, she didn't have the advice of anybody when she started doing it, and she thought, well, if I go to the DC government and I say this is what I'm doing, and they say this is what you need, and they send an inspector down and they say everything's okay, then everything should be okay. Now, it turns out that's not always true in D.C., but she didn't know that at the time.
So was it represented to the government that she was operating a rooming house?
She went to the government and she said she was renting, well, that's a great question for the, have a hearing below. I don't want to speak for my client. I wasn't there. I wasn't representing until more than a year later.
Okay.
So that's where that is. But again, and I want to get to the second, the procedural issue as well. We would obviously prefer just a ruling on the merits that the whole thing is ruling was contrary to law. But the procedural issues here are very, very important because in this case, on March 10th, the ALJ issued an order. This is March 10th of 2016. Issued an order stating that there was a previous hearing missed. However, we had provided enough reason for that hearing to have an opportunity to come to the court and explain why we missed the hearing. There is a rule which I actually was not even aware of until just before I came to court today. This is OAH Rule 2930.1, which states, and I quote, "A petition received by OAH will be treated as a request for a hearing. OAH will schedule a status conference, a hearing, or mediation. This is critical. OAH shall notify the parties of the hearing date and their right to obtain a lawyer at least 15 calendar days before the hearing."
Didn't they do that for the actual? So are you referring to the hearing on the?
Okay. So I'm referring. So on March 10th, the court issued a order stating that there would be a hearing on March 22nd where the housing provider would be entitled to explain why they missed the first hearing and present evidence. March 22nd is only 22 days from March 10th.
Sorry,
it's only 12 days from March 10th. It wasn't enough time. According to this rule, it says OAH will notify the parties of the hearing date and the right to a lawyer at least 15 calendar days before a hearing.
Can you read the first part of that rule again for us? Because we don't have it. I don't have it handy.
Certainly. And I apologize for not.
Oh, no, that's fine. I have it in my office. I just have it here, so it's fine.
Right. The rule is, so it's OAH Rule 2930. The heading is Rental Housing Cases Hearing. And the rule 2930.1, a petition received by OAH will be treated as a request for a hearing. OAH will schedule a status conference, a hearing, or mediation. OAH shall notify the parties of the hearing date and of their right to obtain a lawyer at least 15 calendar days before a hearing.
So does that rule not refer to the actual petition that's filed to set the case in motion in that subsequent hearings thereafter?
It refers to all hearings, and that is because of the choice of the word 15 calendar days before a hearing, not 15 calendar days before the hearing. If it was talking about the initial hearing, the proper word would be, you'd have to say before the hearing. It says that the OAH will notify the parties at least 15 calendar days before a hearing.
Doesn't it also say that once a petition is filed, right? So it requires a petition sets everything in motion, okay? Right? Do you agree? A petition sets it in motion. The first sentence you said says something about a petition being filed, right?
Yes. So the initial part of the rule states that the OAH will treat a petition, you know, the initial petition, as a request for a hearing.
Yes.
Right. But the rest of the rule does not refer only to that hearing. And, you know, stepping back a moment, it's common sense to give civil parties more than 15 days notice for a hearing. In our case, we didn't receive notice of the hearing, actual notice, despite checking the mail every Monday and Thursday. Until one day before the hearing. And that just isn't enough time to show up.
With all due respect, if you have a case with OAH and for whatever reason you decided or someone at your firm decided the logical approach was to do a Mondays and Thursdays mail check, is that on OAH or instead on the decision of the person at your firm?
I don't think it's unreasonable to expect enough. I've been practicing since 2012. At no point in my career has anything close to this ever occurred, where a hearing was set with less than 15 days' notice. It's you know, counsel, people go on vacations all the time. People have other hearings. You know, lawyers need a little bit of time to make their, and so do individuals, need a little bit of time to set their calendars. I think it's entirely reasonable to, if you're going to go away, to have somebody checking your mail twice a week, because I don't do the sort of work where you have to be in court the next day. I don't do, you know, the sort of work where there's preliminary injunctions and that sort of thing. And nobody in my field does that. This rule, I think this rule does apply to all hearings because it says 15 days before a hearing and not the hearing in the last sentence. But even if it doesn't apply by the text of it, it certainly demonstrates that that 15 days is sort of the minimum amount of time that one would require in order to give enough notice. Had there been 15 days notice, I could have made it back. It wouldn't have been a problem.
Do you think that could it be reasonable notice? Let's say, for instance, this hearing was, let's see, this hearing was for limited in scope to simply take an evidence that your client did or did not receive notice, right? So it was a limited evidentiary hearing.
Well, I believe the order stated, and this is how it always has been with the OAH, is if once they hear that as a preliminary matter, and then they proceed immediately thereafter to the full evidentiary hearing.
So, okay, so.
I'm sorry, you were under the impression that the hearing that they granted when there wasn't any right to hearing based on the nature of your motion would have, you would have provided representations, and then they would have automatically gone into a hearing on the merits?
That's what happened to me about a month and a half ago at the OAH. That's how the procedure is. That you have, they schedule a hearing. The judge will first listen to the arguments as to why they should grant the hearing at all. And if the judge is satisfied, they proceed immediately to a merits hearing. That's standard practice. So, yes, that is my expectation.
And you're saying that the notice that was issued in this case in connection with your request, which normally doesn't require any form of a hearing, that they normally rule on the papers, that in that instance, your expectation would have gone actually into a hearing on the merits. All of their hearing notices read the same.
I can't say that all of their hearing notices read the same. All I can say to you, right, and I have a lot of papers here, but when I can look during Mr. Castillo's turn on the computer to look at the actual notice.
I have it here.
Okay.
I can tell you what it says. It says, in relevant part, because housing provider asserts that she did not receive the hearing notice, I will schedule a hearing on the motion to take evidence concerning housing provider's receipt or lack of receipt of the hearing notice. It is respondent's burden to present credible evidence that respondent did not receive adequate notice. If I find that the Ratwan factors identified above merit reconsideration, I will schedule an evidentiary hearing on the merits. So, seemed to imply that she was not planning to go into.
That's quite clear.
Okay.
Yeah, Your Honor, thank you. Like I said, I had this experience about 2 months ago in another case, and it was different.
Yeah.
I was assuming it was going to be the same, but I don't have that in front of me. Thank you.
So, given the text of that specific hearing notice and the way in which they described it, it's clearly not a hearing on the merits. So, do you still believe that the 15 days, which could be interpreted for hearings only on the merits before OAH, that you'd still be entitled to 15-day notice on something short of a merits hearing?
It just says a hearing. It doesn't say a merits hearing.
Very well.
I don't see any reason why it would be read narrowly.
Mr. Horner?
Yes.
Why wasn't your when did your client get notice of the March 22nd hearing, and why didn't she attend?
Well, my client lives in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. As she stated in her affidavit, she had moved about, I want to say 4 months, but several months earlier, she had moved to a new address. She called the OAH twice to ask them to change her address, and they didn't. So she was getting notice when the post office would forward the mail from her old house to her new house. She got notice of this March 22nd hearing on March 23rd because that's how long it takes for that forwarding to occur.
And why is it that no one was in attendance at the hearing that was scheduled for December 5th?
As I stated in the brief,
wasn't an attempt to even call in or request a telephonic appearance?
No, it was not that was a error at my firm, and that is we were arguing that it was excusable neglect. What had happened is we had had Dan Snow was our former attorney on the case. He left the firm. And there was an error in the handoff, and that case didn't, the calendar just didn't show up on my calendar when we handed it off, and that was our mistake.
So did your client get notice? Because it seems like the record reflects that the notice went out in September for the December hearing. Mm-hmm. So did your client also not get notice for the December hearing in September?
I'm not sure. That would be an excellent question for her at the OAH at an evidentiary hearing. That's why that should happen.
But it seemed to me that that would be all, pertinent information that you would put into your request for reconsideration, just about exactly what was amiss for there to be no representation at the December hearing, or even a request for a telephonic.
Well, we couldn't request a telephonic hearing because we didn't know about it. We did request a telephonic hearing on March 22nd, and the judge denied it, and I can't figure out why for the life of me.
It was the day of the hearing, about an hour before.
That's right.
Okay.
But that's the best we could do. As soon as I got notice of the hearing, I immediately, wrote up my fast motion as quickly as I could. I talked to my law clerk. I sent him to the hearing to ask, to ask for a continuance and also to, call me and to ask the judge to call me. I would have been willing and ready to, conduct the hearing remotely if that's the best I could have done. We did everything we could do at that time, and it just really boggled my mind actually that given the court had already decided in its March 10th order that we had presented enough evidence for a hearing. Or to earn a hearing, it was a capricious change of heart on on the 22nd to find under the same situation that we hadn't. Nothing had changed except for that we couldn't come to the second hearing because we didn't know about it. This is not how it's supposed to go. This is the Court of Appeals has been very clear about the importance of deciding cases on the merits. And it's also said that the slightest abuse of discretion justifies reversal in a case where where a party has not been heard on the merits. It just can't be the rule that attorneys, while they have cases pending, can't travel. And that's what the effect is here. Like, if there's a chance that you're not going to hear about a hearing until the day before it occurs, you can't travel at all. And that's not sensible. It doesn't. Like I said, it boggled my mind when I saw that. I tried everything I could do to make it right, and we just couldn't.
So I want to go back to the window. Mm-hmm. You started out by mentioning that OEH doesn't have jurisdiction in this particular issue. Where do you think it belongs?
The proper action, which is done all the time, is to file a case in Superior Court for a violation of the warranty of habitability. Typically, that is raised as a defense to an eviction. It can also be raised as an affirmative claim in small claims, and I've done those cases before. I would love to bring them here. If I could bring them here, I could get attorney's fees. But that's not how it works. If it did, it would completely dramatically change how landlord-tenant works in this city.
So I have a hard time reconciling the premise that a reduction can occur under the Rental Housing Act if it existed at the time of tenancy with case law that goes back to 1988. And so here's a Court of Appeals case. I'll give you the name of it so you can look at it as well. It's Mudd versus the D.C. Rental Housing Commission. And it's MUDD. The citation is, it's 546, a second, 440. And I'll read a line here just so we could maybe see if we're on the same page. A landlord's failure to provide basic services and facilities, such as a working stove, refrigerator, and heat, constituted a reduction in services under the code. And these were services that were not provided at the start of the tenancy. And so
Well, Your Honor, I guess when Mr. Castillo is up, I'll take a look at that case. I based my arguments on the cases that were cited by the ALJ. The ALJ cited Paracco versus DC Rental Housing Commission for the proposition that that it doesn't have to actually be a substantial reduction for it to be count as a reduction under the statute. And that case does not say that. Very clearly does not say that.
Yeah.
So that's the situation I was in when I looked at that. It seems like a remarkable issue, given the evidence in the case. You know, like I said, the window was 2 inches smaller than code. It wasn't something that Mr. Castillo couldn't escape out of quite easily. I questioned that it was a substantial reduction even on the facts.
Well, DCRA said that no one should be living in that space because of the window, right?
DCRA issued a notice of violation. Ultimately, the landlord was not punished for it. And Mr. Castillo went to Housing Conditions Calendar Court to ask the court to force the landlord to fix it. The court dismissed his case because he was arguing that he could not escape. We set up a time to come and demonstrate that he could or could not escape. Mr. Castillo refused to show up for that, refused to cooperate with the court. And the judge, of course, at that point, because Mr. Castillo didn't prove his case, dismissed the case. So in this case, I've been to this window. It's smaller than it should be. The landlord very much regrets renting it out in the first place. She didn't know. She's been trying to remedy the situation. She offered Mr. Castillo a room upstairs. He's refused that. This came out in our, my client is, after trying to help Mr. Castillo find a different room that was, the landlord charges $700 a month for the upstairs room, offered to move Mr. Castillo up there for the same price he was paying. Mr. Castillo refused to go. Which indicates to me that Mr. Castillo does not actually believe it's that dangerous, because if he was, he had the opportunity to go, and he just didn't take it.
How long did he stay in the room that he shouldn't have been in?
He's still there. We tried to get him out every way we could. We filed a case. My client decided she would try to move back into that room and just herself live there, but we couldn't get the eviction through because we can't get the property registered because the window is too small. It's this ultimate catch-22 situation, which isn't particularly relevant to what's in front of the court, but it's been tremendously frustrating for my client. She just, and as to the case here, she just wants to be heard on the merits and to make these arguments, in front of the judge.
Okay.
Any more questions?
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to tell you, Mrs. Castillo, because you look really excited. It's your time to shine. You can talk now. So it's your. Oh. You have 20 minutes.
Oh. I didn't know if I was allowed to object to anything he said at that
point. No, so...
This is between me and you and him and you, right?
Yeah, so okay. You talk to us. Okay. We'll ask you questions. Probably the best use of your time is to explain why the decision, whether you like it or don't like it.
First, I'd like to say that the attorney needs to get up to date on this case because he's misquoting things. The window has been enlarged already. So there was a problem enough, at least for the landlord, to enlarge it.
When was it enlarged?
I don't know, about maybe a month ago, a month and a half or 2 months ago. It has been enlarged. I was represented by the Legal Aid Society as well. I think the pressure from Legal Aid as well, because she's trying to file an eviction to move into an inhabitable room. Their position was that, well, if I can't live in there, she certainly can't live in there either. But either way, it's been enlarged. It's been brought up to code somewhat. There was an egress as well that's still there, which they say it has breakaway screws. I don't think there's no such thing as breakaway screws. Maybe on a space shuttle or something.
Well, have you attempted to schedule a demonstration?
Well, the window opens up. Yeah, but the window is supposed to open up this way. If I'm here against the wall, the window is supposed to open up this way. The window opened out. The only way to do a demonstration is to break the whole window and then go through this existing... I'd have to crawl over a window that only opens up to here, over top of here, to get into the window.
So if the landlord is willing to do a demonstration and possibly break the window, if that's what's required, to show you that you can get out of the place, why would you be opposed to that?
They never said that they were going to... they didn't include breaking out the window. I explained to them. They never responded back that it was going to break. I felt the position that they were taking is if it's broken, they don't have to fix it. If it's not fixed, then I would definitely have to move out because there'd be a broken window there. And it was in the middle. I don't know. I was going to say it was in the middle of winter, but I'm not sure.
But isn't that why your case got dismissed over from Superior Court? Because... It has here in the case notes, mm-hmm. Window designed to break was scheduled for test, but plaintiff canceled due to dental appointment and refused to reschedule. Plaintiff represents window has to be broken to conduct tests, and there was no point in rescheduling. Case dismissed for want of prosecution.
Right. No, I kind of got argumentative because they were kept saying that I could go out through that window because there was outside the window – there was a shield
mm-hmm.
covering the window well. Even if I got through the window, I wouldn't make it past the shield. It was screwed into the foundation. And I was arguing that. I said, they kept saying that it has breakaway screws. It's kind of complex.
Okay.
There's pictures. In
no, we've seen the pictures. Yeah. And okay, you could go to the next issue.
Yes, sir. I'd like to, okay. This lengthy process began in July 7, 2015. The process proceeded over a period of a year. It was never rushed. A lease is a binding contract held in accordance to terms, some of which are naturally protected by common law. In exchange for my signature and rental deposit, any tenant at a minimum would have the following rights protected. A safe, secure space, a right to quiet enjoyment, and a legal foundation to base the contract on.
Mr. Castillo, I hate to interrupt you. I respect your time a lot.
Oh.
And so I see that you're reading from the document you just filed with us. Your time is probably better spent explaining focused on the decision below as to why it should stand or why should we change it as Mr. As the counselor suggests we should.
Well, I outlined this here. This is only five pages. I'm sure I can get through five pages within 20 minutes.
You're welcome to read them. Yeah, go ahead.
The obligations of creating a legal foundation which would allow a rental unit to be placed upon the market is the responsibility of the landlord. When a landlord does not abide by the state's landlord obligations, rental taxes are not paid, public safety is ignored, and income that is not accounted for by the state is earned. In the District of Columbia, a multi-unit rental is required by law to have a basic business license and a certificate of occupancy. Only after the Rental Accommodation Division discovered the premise to be illegal, in illegal standing by the investigator, Deborah Britt of DCRA, a basic business license was initially obtained for 601 Buchanan Street Northeast. By misrepresenting the number of occupied tenants as a single-family rental instead of declaring it a multi-unit rental. A continued decision to deceive the law after the residence was brought to attention by DCRA. By doing this, enforceable regulations would be reduced by the city in order to manage the property. A property with seven tenants would need to be managed similar to a bed and breakfast or a hotel. This property has never been completely registered with the District of Columbia. For the 9+ years, the landlord has been benefiting from unaccounted rental income. To date, the basic business license was once again obtained by declaring it a single family income. No certificate of occupancy has been obtained. Exhibit 5 license contained in the landlord's motion for reconsideration shows a license for once again a single family rental unit. 7 tenants live here. The appropriate license to be obtained is a multi-unit license. My rental agreement was made under the assumption and taken for granted that the apartment I rented was properly registered, safe, and habitable. It was not, and I was unnecessarily made the target of several evictions by retaliation, not by necessity. Over 1 year after the final order was issued by the Office of Administrative Hearings, the property is still in illegal standing, but not fully complying with the D.C. regulations. This constitutes the premise that conditions complained existed from the inception of the tenancy. The specific conditions an unregistered landlord selling me an inhabitable room, it is argued that a reduction in services does not have to be made after an initial contract is considered legal. Approaching the table of negotiation, each party is responsible to operate in good faith. The case was made against Rosalind Burgess, who hired Daniel Hornell for representation, who assigned the case to Daniel Snow. Daniel Snow never withdrew his appearance in the case. Both attorneys work in the same law firm. Both attorneys have entered a notice of appearance in the specific case. All three parties are responsible for the dates and progress of the Office of Administrative Hearing sets, as well as myself. A detailed itinerary of the case proceedings and dates were sent out in advance in the inception of the case from Judge Teal, sent out on June 28, 2016, contained in tab 21, and updated on September 26, contained in tab 26. Evidence of notice
for housing violations submitted as evidence were made via messages or email to the landlord as issues came up or were noticed, which were met with a nonchalant response or redirected to a non-existent project manager. These text messages or emails many times included detailed pictures.
I'm going to ask you a quick question.
Yes, sir.
Did the project, the property manager, did he live on site?
No, no. There wasn't really a project manager. At one point, it was her father. He had alcoholic problem issues. Then it was a friend from North Carolina that came up. There wasn't really a project manager permanently assigned.
Okay.
Should I read the rest of this, or is this being submitted?
You continue reading.
Because critical repairs were left unaddressed, I had no choice but to go to the DCRA Housing Conditions Counter Court for existing housing code violations. An evidentiary hearing on the – this is a timeline for the core issues.
Take your time.
An evidentiary hearing on the tenant petition was conducted on December 5th, 2016. A final order was issued and sent out on December 12th, 2017. Thank you. Much consideration in making a judgment was entered into the landlord, was extended to the landlord in the final order because she was not present on December 5th. Evidentiary hearings, I wear glasses, so that's why I'm having problems with
this. Take your time. We can read along with you as well. So.
Evidentiary hearings to defend herself. No proposed exhibits from the landlord were filed with OHA or sent to me in preparation for the hearing. My proposed exhibits submitted for the hearing, which were sent out in advance of that hearing, were never returned back to me. A motion for reconsideration was filed on December 27, 2017. The motion was based on the assertion that the landlord did not receive the hearing notice. At this point, the landlord is questioning the integrity of the Office of Administrative Hearings and previously had questioned my integrity. Order setting hearings on motion for reconsideration was granted on March 10, 2017 to specifically show evidence concerning housing providers' receipt or lack of receipt of the hearing notice. On March 22, 2017, present at the hearing, myself, the tenant petitioner, and listed on the rental housing attendance sheet, council rep for the Council for Housing Provider, who was granted exceptional latitude in a limited appearance given that he was not an attorney or admitted to practice in Washington, D.C. At the hearing, council rep mentioned and the attorney mentioned in his appeal an excuse for not attending That excuse again calls into question a second time the integrity of the Office of Administrative Hearings. Important communication to Germany, which initially was established via a phone line, becomes perplexing within a legal practice because his clerk chooses to abruptly, casually communicate a quick approaching hearing date via Facebook, sent on March 21st for a hearing scheduled on March 22nd, the very next day. It goes without saying a follow-up phone message was definitely in order within a legal practice. The attorney states that he learned about the hearing only a few hours prior to its scheduled start because he is in Germany. He could not attend in those few hours. The attorney failed to consider calling the Office of Administrative Hearings from Germany during that emergency. Right then and there, and there was time. The excuse would have been perhaps more palatable under the plea for help. Instead, the office clerk, who was granted limited appearance on behalf, proposed to have the OHA court call Daniel. The OHA court called Daniel to Germany. The judge's discretion was clearly made because of the manner and the lack of concern that this significant issue presented to her. The housing provider was aware of the allegations made against her in the tenant petition, and again in its amendment, and once again in its ancillary cases, specifically the DCRA housing conditions counter case, that resulted from her neglect as a landlord. The tenant petition was filed against her. She hired an attorney, two attorneys, filed and entered to appear in the case on this landlord's behalf, Daniel Snow and Daniel Hornell. It is clearly the landlord's responsibility to keep up with the progress of how a case is brought before her. Is proceeding in the end judgment. One moment. It is clearly the landlord's responsibility to keep up with the progress of the case brought before her on how it's proceeding. In the end, judgment could possibly be made against her, not against her attorneys. The landlord has chosen to put her case in autopilot. It does not excuse her responsibility or ignorance. The case proceeded over 1 year. All previous documents that were sent were successfully received. The housing provider was notified twice in advance communication of the approximate time frame that the proceeding would take place, contained in tab 21 order sent June 28, 2016, and updated in tab 26 order sent September 26, 2016. At the inception of the hearing, in which the landlord attended via a landline, the judge asked me to update the case by submitting a motion to amend the tenant petition, if I wish, because much time has passed. Since I filed the initial tenant petition. I elected to do so and sent out copies. The landlord was updated with additional violations at that time, contained in tab 22, accepted on July 26, 2016. One more. A landlord has been renting the property for over 9 years with seven tenants occupying the residence at any given time. Not a small residential landlord. The attorney quotes, as many residential landlords in the District of Columbia, Ms. Burgess was unaware of the extensive regulatory scheme for rental housing. And that was stated in the initial notice of appeal to OHA on page 5. Excusable neglect is a housing provider's defense in the initial appeal to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Excusable neglect is not synonymous with carelessness or inattentiveness, and that's stated in a case listed here, Toshine. I can't pronounce the name.
No, we have it here.
The landlord submitted that she refused delivery of my mail tenant petition in a text message sent to me on October 2nd, contained in tab. In tab referencing the date September 10th, 2015. I immediately filed a motion for petitioner's objection to respondent's continuance on October 16th. Her request for continuance via email sent on October 2015 stated she changed her address. However, she herself previously sent me text messages refusing my petition, contained in tab 7, October 2015. Order overruling objection was made on October 21st, 2015, contained in tab 11, November 21st, 2015. A tactic as an appellant is to try to characterize the lower court ruling as a mistake of law because you can then start with a clean slate and not be disadvantaged because you lost below. Continuous mistakes were made by the landlord and the attorneys representing her. The landlord is ultimately responsible for her own case. The inexcusable carelessness of disregard for her representation allows her to sue her own attorneys, perhaps to recover the monetary judgment the OAH has ruled to me. But this case proceeded over a lengthy period of time, followed by a meticulous procedural outline, following a procedural outline, was extremely considerate of her absence in final judgment, allowed her flexibility in defending her assertion for not receiving case documents from myself or the Office of Administrative Union. Excuses made over and over by legal representation does not excuse her from her business obligations and ignorance of the law when renting a multi-unit.
Thank you. Any questions?
Were you having, did you take, no, that was very
no questions.
Thank
okay.
you so very much.
Yes.
Thank you. 5 minutes.
Thank you. I have a few things to say. First, just to correct something, we on the date of the 22nd, I did call OAH, and of course they won't put me through to the judge. That's just not how it works. I asked. To a more important issue as to MUD, first of all, the facts in that case are dramatically different. MUD had no working stove, no refrigerator, no heat, no electricity during the winter, and no toilet. That is a very different situation than having a window that is a couple of inches too small.
But is the point here not the appliances or the window issue, but the fact that a reduction can be deemed appropriate for things that actually occurred or predated the tenancy?
This is my second point. The plaintiff in that case did not challenge the RHC's interpretation of the law for reduction to not really mean reduction. The plaintiff in that case, in MUD, raised a constitutional challenge to the police powers of the RHC and the rent control scheme in general. The Court of Appeals overturned that or disagreed with appellee's assertions there. The court did not determine that a interpretation of the statute for reduction to not really mean reduction is lawful.
I wanted to inquire when downstairs when you filed your initial pleading for reconsideration of the default judgment. My understanding is they do not warrant or require any type of hearing. Is that your understanding?
I do not believe the judge is required to issue a hearing. The judge decided to.
In your initial pleading for a motion for reconsideration, did you ask for an evidentiary hearing within the four corners of your pleading?
If I did or not.
The reason why I ask that is that my understanding is the practice down there and is that for motion to reconsideration, you essentially have to provide all of the information in the four corners of that pleading for the judicial officer to reconsider because you're not going to get a hearing. And so because they don't normally give hearings, they'll grant them. And so within that initial pleading that you had sent on your initial request based on the default judgment, it was clear in her default the reasons why she, you all just didn't appear. Much to Commissioner Gregory's questions, I was at a loss when I was looking through your initial pleading that you actually provided sufficient factual basis to the judge to actually grant your request and to vacate the default, because her initial question was essentially, as Commissioner Gregory had said, why was the housing provider not present or why weren't you present? And normally within those types of pleadings, because you do not get a hearing, practitioners often basically, you throw in the kitchen sink, you throw in all the explanations, because it is not the normal practice that the court will entertain a secondary hearing so you can essentially bolster your pleading, because your pleading should stand on its own. So I was just wondering what the thinking was when you filed your initial motion not to put in more of a factual basis. That's all.
I'm not sure exactly what I was thinking at that point. It was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that we put in what we believe to be sufficient reason for the court to grant our motion. The court decided to hold a hearing instead. Mm-hmm. The court's completely unjustified reversal of that on March 22nd, when circumstances on March 22nd were very, very clear that our failure to attend was, at best excusable neglect. We certainly showed good cause for the motion for continuance. The change of heart about whether or not we had earned the right to a hearing is the definition of capricious. Nothing had changed, except for the judge, I suppose, was upset at us for not showing up the second time. But not showing up the second time had nothing to do with the first time. We had very, very clear evidence as to why we weren't there.
But when you filed your motion for reconsideration of the default, was there a particular reason why the motion was kind of thin on basis for the Radwan factors? Even if she had not let you appear and decided to look through your papers, that's essentially what those things are. You provide information within, she initially denied it because there just wasn't enough information.
Well, she didn't deny it. She scheduled a hearing. As to the Radwan factors, we did present evidence of good faith. We did act promptly, which is what, certainly we would have probably written a longer motion had we had more time, but we had to get this done as soon as possible, out of respect for the court and also under the case law. We presented a prima facie defense, which is that which we haven't talked about yet in this hearing, but the lack of notice is an even more serious issue. The uncontested evidence is that my client didn't have notice about the window until the inspection report came out. But the ALJ found my client liable for reduction to rent for the entire time of the tenancy. That's a prima facie defense, and certainly exhibit damage.
So you're suggesting that in order for your client to be held responsible, DCRA and or Mr. Castillo was required to inform your client of the violation of the code?
Absolutely. That is absolutely the law in the District of Columbia. In every case regarding the warranty of habitability and in the case law, as quoted by the ALJ, in this case noted that notice must be provided to the landlord. If the landlord doesn't have notice from somebody, could be the tenant, could be DCRA, could be anybody, but the landlord has to have notice of a problem in order to be held liable to correct it. That's also just common sense.
Mr. Hormel?
Yes.
I guess that leads me to what would have been the adequate defense with regard to the lower court finding that the housing accommodation was not properly registered. It seems as if she had gotten notice about a year and a half before that the property was not registered. So what was the adequate defense that you would have brought forward with relation to the registration?
My client's willing to pay that fine. That was not challenged. My client would you know, of course, like to negotiate that with the DCRA regarding the amount of the fine, given that we have papers in the exhibits, the motion for reconsideration, showing that the inspections were done, that she tried to do her best. We think the fine might be too high. But regardless of that, we wouldn't challenge that fine directly.
Is there a reason why she had not gotten registered? It speaks to good faith for me that she did have notice about a year and a half before and still hadn't acted on it.
Sure. The reason she had not been registered at that point was, so first of all, Mr. Castillo made a complaint of failure to register in, I believe it was January of 2015. Immediately upon receiving that complaint, and the text for this is in the exhibits, the motion for reconsideration filed on, reconsideration of December 12th order, which was filed, I think, on December 18th, or something like that. Exhibit one is the inspection report where they had D.C. government come down. The report, by the way, also notes the tenants were home. So the inspector knew about the rooms being occupied by different people and still passed the inspection for the basic business license. The inspection report, there's also attached to that same motion a letter from D.C. government dated January 2nd, 2015, in which the D.C. government says you either need a one-family rental license or a two-family rental license if it's different units. So, you know, my client would argue, if given the opportunity in front of the hearing or in front of the judge, that you know, the fine should be reduced due to her good faith attempts to comply over time, the thing my client's concerned about and the basis for our appeal. You know, if this had just been a failure to register case, I don't think we would be here. It was the reduction of more than 60% of rent for conditions that my client didn't know about till halfway through the tenancy that existed from the beginning of tenancy.
So once your client had knowledge, which was what, July of 2016,
mm-hmm. Why did they register?
No. I'm talking about the window. Mm-hmm. The tenant just mentioned earlier that the window was fixed mm-hmm. approximately a month ago. Mm-hmm. So let's assume that it is the government's responsibility or the tenant's responsibility to inform your client of a deficiency. How long does your client then have to correct a deficiency?
Well, so this is a very long story, and I'm happy to get into it.
The short answer.
Well, I'll try as best I can. Okay. I really apologize. It just requires a little bit of background. My client had talked to experts. So this window is below ground. Mm-hmm. It's a basement window. So it's not a simple matter to make it bigger. My client had talked to contractors who said it couldn't be done for a reasonable price. It'd be extremely expensive, and she simply couldn't afford it. The housing conditions calendar judge agreed with us, and in the transcripts to the hearings at the housing committee or in front of this judge, the judge said, "I find that the window can't be made bigger, and Mr. Castillo, you need to move out." My client, of course, then tried to take care of Mr. Castillo by putting him in an upstairs room. He refused. At that point, you know, we would argue if this were a warranted habitability hearing, we would argue at that point my client, her responsibility were extinguished, and that she offered Mr. Castillo a better room for the same price. He didn't take it.
Well, he could have avoided the lease too, right?
He could have avoided the lease if he had under the void lease theory. I don't think he could have. I don't think it's substantial enough. But that's an argument that could be made at the Superior Court, and we would have that argument in front of them.
So to get back to my question, because I don't think you answered it directly. So assuming that it is the government's responsibility or the tenant's responsibility to notify the housing provider of the deficiency, how long after notice does the housing provider have to correct the issue?
So under the D.C. case law, the law says the landlord must correct the deficiency within a reasonable time.
What would be reasonable, you think, in this situation?
I'd have to talk to a construction expert. And in this particular case, as I said, you know, my client, you know, doesn't have the money to just dig up a foundation and replace a window. So I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure there's anything she could have done differently.
So let's assume that the LOJ said, okay, we won't go back to the start of tenancy. We'll go back to the notice period. So it's hypothetically, let's say July. Matter of fact, we only say July the same day. Say July the following year, okay? So a reasonable time would be a year to fix the issue. Do you think a 60% reduction would be fair or reasonable for that the year following the notice period?
Absolutely not. The 60% reduction is extremely out of proportion.
So it would have been proportionate?
5-10% is probably about right. Okay. In that particular case, it's a fact-specific inquiry. We want to go to the judge and we want to show, well, could he actually get out? And the answer is yes, he could actually get out of that window. You know, there was a rain guard that we put on at the client's request that had the breakaway screws, but it was absolutely, it was not a safety issue. It was a technical code compliance issue, and it's something that, you know, I'm glad my client fixed it or was finally able to. But she certainly shouldn't be responsible to the 60% rent reduction for that entire length of time.
This is my last question. Just out of curiosity, is there any mechanism that your client could have explored with DCRA to appeal the determination as far as the window? To show, like, yes, technically it's 2 inches smaller than it should be, but the person can still live there? Was there...
No, as far as I'm aware, DCRA doesn't have a mechanism for creating exceptions to housing code in specific circumstances. The finding of this housing inspector, it wasn't a judicial finding. This was the housing inspector works for DCRA, but is actually attached to the housing conditions calendar court. And the judge said, okay, Leslie, the site inspector, go out and check this out. And she went out, and then she went out again. And the first inspection had quite a few problems. The second inspection had only a few.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, let's see. I appreciate both of your time and your passionate discussion, and particularly for you for engaging in a lot of questions about these issues that you've raised. It's now 2:09 p.m. and this hearing is hereby adjourned. I'm sorry.
3:09?
Oh, we started at 2 o'clock. The clock I'm looking at is hours behind. I'm sorry. It's 3:09 p.m. and this hearing is now adjourned.
Thank you, Commissioner. I really appreciate your opportunity.
Thank you.